What's up, FC Dallas fans? Welcome back to DTID, the official FC Dallas podcast. I'm your host, Garrett Melser, and today I sat down with Pa Modu-Ka, the head coach of North Texas SC, FC Dallas' development team. Pa spoke a lot about his playing career, which included stops in Europe, the Middle East, and MLS, and eventually what led him to become a coach. This was a really fun episode. I think it's our longest episode. We spoke for almost an hour, but Pa is a great storyteller, and there were some really fun ones in there. I hope you guys enjoyed the episode, and please, if you have any suggestions for future guests, please reach out to me on Twitter at Garrett Melser. Welcome to the podcast, Pa. How are you doing?
Thank you, Garrett. How are you?
I'm doing great. So like I said, this podcast is about you and how you got to where you are now. So let's start from the beginning.
It ain't about me, man. It's about you. You're the boss.
Well, let's talk about you first, at least. You were born in Banjul, the Gambia, before you immigrated to Norway. What was your childhood like before you moved? And is that where you were introduced to soccer originally?
Yeah, you know, like you said, I was born in the Gambia. I was fortunate. My dad... played soccer. My mom played basketball, so I grew up in a household of sport. And just 2 months after I was born, my dad left to go to Norway, and because they had a game. And then he was seen by a professional team in Norway. Then they offered him a contract, so he stayed behind. So the first 8 years, I didn't actually get to see my dad. Besides, at that time was, if we were lucky, a phone call, because the technology was not what it is today. So it was basically me, my mom, with my grandparents. In a household, you know, like in Africa, when you are Muslim, people know, and some of them know that you have two wives. My grandfather had two wives, and it was one big happy family, to be fair. But I didn't also have much. We didn't have much, but we had enough for us to be happy. My mom was working, my dad was supplying us from Europe. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I didn't have nothing in my childhood that I would say that there was nothing left. It was a happy childhood. I could go out and play every day, mm-hmm. you know, because it's Africa. And you get introduced to sport through schools, through your friends, right? You see your uncles play. You see your mom play basketball. So I was very attached to my mom. Mm-hmm. It was like we were inseparable. So when she had basketball games, I would be literally sitting on the bench. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a good childhood.
Mm-hmm. So your dad played soccer, but he wasn't around where you grew mm-hmm. up. How did you get into soccer yourself?
Well, it's because you know, at the time there's no IG, there's no Facebook, there's no Twitter, so there's nothing you can see of somebody. But you do, people tell you stories, right? Mm-hmm. So we were living off the stories that people were telling me about my dad, what my mom was telling me, and what his brothers was telling me. So I was creating my own image and my own picture of imagination of how I thought he would mm-hmm. be on the football field. So until I went to Norway and then I saw him play, so that image that people were creating, I could see it, you know. So for me that was important. But the most important part for my dad was that I got my degree. Mm. I was not playing football. It's like okay. It's like you come into Europe, it's mostly, you know, to get an education, and if you can combine both, good. But there was a choice that I had to make.
Okay. So you moved to Norway at 8. I mean, that's a young age to move anywhere, but yeah. Especially, you know, to Norway. That's a very different place from where you were used yeah. to. What was that like for a kid?
Nah, man, in the beginning, it's tough. It's like I said, I grew up in the Gambia where every day you are out. Mm. Right? And you come to know in the wintertime where everything is dark. Mm. Just picture that, right? Yeah. You used to see in the sun every day, and now you go to a place, it's dark 24/7, wow. right? And there's nobody out because mm-hmm. it's cold. One, it's cold. Secondly, it's foreign. You have to learn a language, you know. But that's why the power of sport is amazing, mm-hmm. right? Because it always unite people. Exactly. And the game of football is a global sport. So for me, growing up and playing the game of football, going to Norway, it was easy because once the ball was put on the floor, you know, you, like, no, you, who you are didn't matter. mm-hmm. at that moment, what your skin is, what your background. It was just about playing football, and that created that vibe that it was easy to get friends mm-hmm. because they saw that you were good at something, which right. helped the integration and helped you mm-hmm. with the language. So for me, it was that. But I remember the first day I land, man, I'll never forget this because I land and, you know, we don't know snow in Africa, right? We heard about it, but you don't mm-hmm. actually see it. And mm-hmm. then I remember just getting out of the plane and I'm like, wow. So that put my hand up and then it just fell on it and it melted in water. I was like, wow. I was like, wow. Called my mom. I'm like, yo, there's some white things falling from the skies that turn into water. What is this? You know? So it was definitely an experience which I cherished a lot. Mm-hmm.
So you began your pro career with Vålerenga in Norway. Yeah. How did you get that first opportunity? How did you become a part of that club? And what was the early days like?
Well, it was strange because the early years was I played till I was 14. Then I stopped. A lot of people know that I stopped because it was to a point where it was not enjoyable the way that I wanted the way football, I saw football and the way I wanted football to be. And so I stopped for a year and I was playing like a rec with my friends. And then one of my best friends was playing for Vålerenga at that time. So and we had a game against them. And he was talking to the coach, so I ended up playing very well in the game. So the coach invited me to come start practicing with them. At first, I was not into it because I was like, "Nah, it's gonna be the same thing, you know. It's gonna be not about football. It's gonna be more about the business side of things, you know." So you were kind of like, "Nah, do I really want to go be part of that again?" And then, obviously, you know, it's always trickle you because that was also a dream. So I was like, you know what, I get to test myself against the best youth players in our neighborhood where Vålerenga was. So I'm like, yeah, why not? Mm-hmm. So I went and then the coach saw what he liked and he asked me to keep practicing. But then I have to give thanks to my Italian coach because he saw more than what I saw. In terms of who I was, and he kept pushing me mm-hmm. towards the goal because I didn't knew because he was like, you come play for me, because it was a little bit of a friction between me and the coach at that time because he did something that me I didn't like, which was because I wear my heart on my sleeve. Mm-hmm. So I saw him, he basically chose a player because that player invited him home for dinner. Huh. So then for me, and you know, for me, I'm like, nah, that's so I went to play for the U14s, but the second team of the U14s because they had the Italian coach and my other best friend was playing there. So I was like, nah, so I'd rather go play for him. Mm-hmm. And he was like, listen, you play for me one season, I bring you up to the first team.
Wow.
And I'm like, what is this guy talking about? You know, like when people tell you that you're young, you're like, goes 1 year, go all the year. You're like, nah, this guy is full of it, right? Because you're like, this guy's training the U15, U14s, and now he's going to turn me into a first team player. He's like, nah, this guy is a joke. Mm-hmm. So I would just keep laughing, but he was somebody that he was very demanding. He was his expectations, demands were very high. So he installed it also in us, in our players. So I was like one day and I'm in the clubhouse and all of a sudden I see a picture with the U18s and he's standing to the guy that is the head coach of the first team.
Okay.
So then is when he clicked, right? Because then he clicks because then you're like, oh, so he's serious. He's
possible.
Nah, it's not a joke. So then you start being more open-minded and then you start listening more just to gather more information. And from there, you just went boops at 16 and then just start training with the first team.
Without that kind of person in your life, that coach specifically, like were you dreaming of being a professional already? Or was he the one who kind of made that a real option for you?
No, he made it a real option for me, I'll be honest, because at that time, it's people can talk about racism and all of this stuff. It was also in Europe but it was a different racism. That's what I was saying. Europe has this emotional racism that they won't tell you, but you feel it emotionally what they think about you.
Okay.
Right? So for me it was one of those, right? Yes, I had the talent, but I didn't have the door or the opportunities like all these other people had.
Yeah.
Right? So for me it was a needle in a haystack. Mm-hmm. Right, so I needed somebody to open that door. I needed somebody to push the door for me.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Right, and he did it.
Wow.
Right, and he pushed that door for me. And that because of that, I will be ever be grateful. Mm-hmm. Because if he didn't push that door in for me, I may have made it, maybe, but that's, we don't know. Right? Because there's always hindsight. Mm-hmm. But for what he did, that's why I will be forever grateful. That's why also it's one of my mission is to always make sure that people that are coming behind me, whoever you are, that I'm there to also push doors open.
Mm. So similar life lesson almost.
From similar. No, he was talking Donato Biagio, Italian guy. What a guy. I'm telling you, man, what a guy. He was magnificent. He saw things, predicted things that me myself I didn't know, because he even wrote a note that when I started playing for him, he wrote a note that when I stopped, I would be a coach.
Mm.
And I didn't know that.
Okay, interesting. I have a similar question about that later, actually. So you broke through with Vålerenga, put a year in Sweden, and then went to the Netherlands with the Roda. Yeah. That's where you spent most of your career, or longer than anywhere else. Looking back, is that the highest level you played at, you think, with? Because you were also playing consistently with the Norwegian national team at the same time.
No, I mean, in Europe, it was obviously growing up, you always have your dreams. And like I said, I was fortunate also to spend time in Manchester United, I think right before Kenny Cooper came, I was there. And then I was unfortunate where I got injured, and then, you know, the deal didn't happen. But the life lessons also that I got being around the Manchester United at the time, when they were Manchester United, was a fantastic lesson for me to carry on, and I still carry some of those lessons, because it's applied to life as well. So when people talk about Sir Alex Ferguson, that was a real manager, and I was fortunate enough to see him work, but also, you know, just observe him, observe players like Roy Keane, Paul Scholes, David Beckham, Dwight York, Andy Cole, Jaap Stam. So at their peak. So I was very, so that for me was to be in that team around those players at their peak was fantastic, because it gave me a life lesson that I still carry to this day. You know, not everybody get those chances, right? So I was fortunate enough to get the chance. Not fortunate enough to sign, because I injured myself. I think it was one of the lowest days for my mom, because she was a Man U fan. She was a proper man. I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm a Liverpool fan.
There we go.
I'm a Liverpool fan. I'm nothing to do with Man U, but I would have swallowed my pride.
For Manchester United.
I would have swallowed my pride back then. But I mean, it was just to be around that environment was just fantastic. And then you coming back, obviously you play for the national team, and you've been the first black man to play for the national team in Norway, you know. So you break down barriers, and it was good to do, because when I look at the national team now, and I look at years after what happened, it's like you see more and more foreign players playing, and It is a joyful thing to watch, because that means that you were trendsetter for something that I don't even think about, to be fair, because for me it was nothing, something I was thinking of during my career until my career was done, and my friend actually reminded me of what I've actually done. For me it was huge. So you don't think about those stuff. So moved to Sweden, crazy place, loved it. Get to play one of the biggest team in Sweden, AIK Solna. Then for a year and a half, then moved to Roda, which was, another fantastic milestone for me, because I get to play in the Dutch league. At that time, it was fantastic, you know, with top class players. You had Luis Suarez, you have Zlatan, you have Wesley Sneijder, Van der Vaart, Maxwell, Schivo at the time, Ajax, Solomon Kalou, Derek Kuyt. So
it's my favorite player of all time.
Derek Kuyt. So to be able to play against a guy like Derek Kuyt, who was a beast of a striker, didn't complain. And I mean, a lot of good players that at that time that, you know, that played proper football. So for me, it was a joy to be part of that. And yeah, it was the place I stayed the longest.
Mm-hmm.
And just because the relationship I had with the owner.
Okay. Going back a little bit, you mentioned your national team career. But you were playing for your adopted country, playing for Norway. Did you, before you had played for Norway or cap tied or whatnot, did you ever consider playing for the Gambia?
Oh yeah, of course. That's where I was born, and I wanted to follow my dad's footstep. But you know, like with life, you gotta make choices, right? Yeah. So that's what I say. What we have now was not back then, right? We didn't have the IGs, we didn't have the exposure that that people would look at Gambia in a certain way. So it was a choice for me to be made whether to play for Norway and to play for Gambia. And it was a tough choice because you're like, am I betraying my own country? You know, and then you have to think, all right. And it was a simple choice because my dad just went, all right, sit down, make your pros and cons for both. And then you go with the choices. And I was like, and you think about the life choices was like at that time, obviously was right for me to pick Norway because I got to play for 20 years. I don't know if I would have had that playing for Gambia because that exposure was not what is it right now, right? And those players that were playing right now, representing Gambia right now, we went to our first AFCON and that was amazing, you know. That just shows the level of talent now, but back then was not. So do I regret my choice? No, I think at that moment for me personally in what I wanted to do as a football player as well, I think was the right choice, and it showed out later because of not only thinking of me but what came after me, right? So you know that you broke another door, you know.
Absolutely.
Which has always been something in my mind always if I want to do stuff. So it was not easy because, like I say, you encounter the racism side, which was unfortunate, but which also taught me lessons, which I'm always grateful for because for me, it's everything's about learning.
Absolutely. Back to your club career after Rota, you went to the Middle East first with Qatar and then Saudi Arabia. And I'm interested in this because I would say Middle Eastern leagues are the ones I probably know the least about. Of any, like the only, you know, you don't hear about often, maybe a European player goes there late, like Javi or whatnot. But what is the sport like over there? I know they're passionate. I know they're diehard. But
money, man,
like?
Money.
Oh, yeah.
Money. Financial freedom. I mean, I'm honest because that's the reason you don't go there for the game. You love the game, but you're also there for financial security. And the money that you get paid there, it's
different.
It's different type of money. So you'll be stupid not to take those money.
That makes sense.
And then after me, I was playing in the year. I left when I was 31. So for me, it was another adventure in the books, right? So after you play for such a long time in Europe, you're like, all right. Or in MLS was in the picture, but obviously, you know, you got to weigh up your options, which was, for me, was a simple option. I can secure more financially for my family without worrying about what I want to do next.
Yeah.
And for me, that was an easy choice. But also to learn the culture. For me, those things are very important. Everywhere I go to learn the culture, see different. Yes, I have a lot of friends that were from Middle East. But living in Middle East is different to having people that you know that is living. So for me, just to see it, and what I can say about the country of Qatar was magnificent. Very good people. Right. If you have to think about Qatar, is size of maybe Dallas.
Yeah, it's small.
Right. Maybe the size of Dallas. And the country you maybe have, the real original Qataris are what, 300,000, 400,000. So the rest of the country is made of expats. You know, that are there to work. Right. And obviously people will talk about, the foreign workers like the Bangladeshi, the Indians who come in there to work. And obviously you see different side of it, everything. I was fortunate to see everything and form my own opinion, not an opinion based upon what media outlets are saying and stuff like this. So what I saw was a country that was looking to get better and recognized in form of sports, because sports give you a good recognition. Sports give your country something that people can
worldwide. Everyone understands it.
Exactly. So for them, it was trying to create something that they can be respected in, which is sport. Yeah. Right? Sports give you the respect as well. So them holding the World Cup, obviously we all know about the bribes and everything, but for me it's like, why not? Because in the sense of he's a country that's trying to make something, why not we all go see, open our eyes, see how different people are living, see how they act. So being there was magnificent, but the local talent, it was not as good as in Saudi. Saudi was tremendous. When you talk about a league that people actually went, it's crazy, because in Qatar they paid the workers to come to the stadium.
Really?
Unbelievable scenes. It was really nice because, like I said, culture, right? So the football culture is not as here, right? When it's game time, everybody's their mind, they're like into the game. There they're standing, you know, talking to the opposition, kissing cheek to cheek, you know, laughing. But when the game starts, like they're at it. But in the beginning, right, you used to like dialed in and going into there. So that was also another way for me just to see it. And I was laughing because I'm like, yeah, when it's game time, you know, your focus is on. But them, that was, but that was a funny part. But in Saudi, level of talent is
solid.
Yeah.
I know that they're one of the powerhouses in the Asian tournaments.
Saudi is structure. It's like what other countries have structure in football. Mm-hmm. If they had structured football, they would be. They had all talents, man.
Yeah.
I saw some proper talents. But yeah, they don't have the structure, but also they don't have the need to leave their country because they get paid.
Yeah, because the league is so popular.
Yeah.
It's how like Mexico is. The league is so popular, they get paid more in their home country.
More, so you don't want to leave.
Can be an issue for the U.S. too. A couple years ago. Mm-hmm. Speaking of the U.S., right after your time in the Middle East, you came to MLS, Portland, and then Vancouver.
Yeah.
What was the motivation to come to MLS?
Motivation was my wife, not me. I was good. I was getting paid. I didn't have no worries. But my wife was, because when we went to Saudi, because that's what I say with the difference of cultures, right? In Qatar, she could drive. Right? She's free driving. In Saudi, she can't drive.
Wow.
So she couldn't drive in Saudi. You just see the differences in country, right?
My goodness.
Same neighborhood.
Yeah.
Same places, but two different laws.
Ah,
right.
So I didn't consider that
part. Exactly. So that's why I say culture is always good.
Yeah.
But the part that me I always sell to people is there's always what you see and what is happening inside the country is two different things.
Mm-hmm.
What people portray and what is truly happening is two different stuff. So for me to see that it was of course it was mind boggling. I was laughing because I'm like we're living in the 2020th century, so what people have done. But hey, again, it's their laws, and as I said, because one story I tell you is funny, it's crazy because the law within the country for them to just, I won't say even it's a law, it's just a tradition for women to, you know, to carry the hijabs and stuff like that. So obviously, we respect the rules, me being Muslim, my wife being Muslim, so we understand it. But then also we know that you don't need to have that hijab, but you need to cover yourself out of respect, right? So my wife was covering it. We walking into the mall, and all of a sudden they have this thing called Mutawa, which is the Muslim police, like they call it like this. So the guy comes up to me. He goes, "Yeah, your wife needs to cover his hair." So I look at him first. You know, I'm like, "Why?" He goes, "Yeah, but that's the law." I said, "Bro," I'm like, "You're talking to somebody that's Muslim as well, just like you." And that changed his man's perspective because he saw me, I'm black, I have a white woman, and he's like, "Oh," I'm like, "She's Muslim too, by the way." So then the tone of the conversation changes, and then he was like, but she after. I said, "That's your rule. But if you can show me where in the Quran it states that." He said, "Because I know the Quran, like you know the Quran. So which verse are we talking about?" Then the dynamic of the conversations changes. And he was like, it's just, you know, it's our rule. I said, "I respect that. You know, I respect that. We'll do it. But let's not put religion and tradition into one thing." So that was a good thing also to see how different, because no car, they're not allowed to drive anything. So even me going into the supermarket, again, we talk about racism, right? Even me into the supermarket, because I know what they're talking about. I'm with my wife. And then they're like, "Ooh, look at this one, he's dark and he's helping this woman to carry all this stuff." Then I pay and they're like, "Who is he?" Right? So then the tone of the conversation and the tone of everybody start different. So that's just where how people, the narrative and the perspective of people when they see something that they're not accustomed to. Right? And so it was funny. So you see that. But overall, the experience in the Middle East was fantastic. Man, it was fantastic. My wife got sick one day. And we had to go to the pharmacy, and she was out throwing up, and I was there trying to buy stuff, and I turned around and I see my wife, and I freaked out because I'm like, "What happened here?" So I ran out, and she was throwing up on the side, and then the guy stopped his car, brought tissue, brought water,
my goodness,
and waited.
Hmm.
So that's telling you just how people will not think like they can be like this, right?
Our perception is not that.
That's the perception, right? Yeah. Perception is all. Militant group, crazy countries, but deep down inside in both countries, magnificent, man. I tell you, man, magnificent. For me, I always tell people, go visit, make up your own mind, and then you'll see the difference.
That's a great point.
So with that, back to that. So we're playing in Saudi because my wife couldn't drive, so she always has to wait for me.
Yeah.
Even though if you travel maybe 2 days away, and because Saudi is big.
Yeah.
What people forget is Saudi is massive.
Like the whole peninsula, that country.
Massive. Yeah. right? So even going to one place that you have to take a flight, right? So just like here in the US. So she was making videos, highlights, right, on YouTube. And then I got a call from a friend of mine, Oscar Olsen, who's now agent. And we were just talking because he wanted to bring players to the Middle East. And I just, out of fun, and I just go, out of curiosity, I go, hey, does MLS need a retiring center back? Because I was at the age, I was 33. I'm like, yes, why not try the MLS for 1 year just for experience-wise? And then 1 week later, I got three options, which was Vancouver, Portland, and LA. But then it came down also to money-wise, and as well as who had the budget at the time.
Yeah.
So I ended up choosing Portland because watching that at the time, Caleb, how Caleb played spoke well to me. So that's how I ended up in Portland.
They have that environment too up there.
Wow, brilliant, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
In North America, for me so far, in the stadiums that I played in and been part of, there's nothing that beats the Portland Timbers.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah.
On when we are doing the national anthem. If you don't get goosebumps while the national anthem is, you're not ready to play the game. I'm telling you, Garrett, you're not ready to play the game. It's the best feeling for a soccer player. And me witnessing that, I'm like, nah, I'm like, wow. And anybody that came to visit, that was the first thing they would say when they came to visit Portland. They're like, nah, the atmosphere was fantastic.
Yeah,
still,
yeah.
It's...
Which makes sense. I like their stadium, too. It's an interesting, converted old baseball.
Yeah,
It's... But they did a great job with it because a lot of baseball stadiums don't convert well.
You did it well. No, Merritt was a top man. He done well.
I'm curious. MLS wasn't what it was back then, what it is now, in terms of quality, popularity, and everything. Was it kind of a culture shock, sporting-wise, to go to that level? And maybe, like, the lack of interest in comparison to the Middle East or Europe in terms of soccer as a popular sport?
Nah, for me, it's you talk about adaptation. For me, it doesn't matter if it's 1 or 100,000. The love of the game is what is the most important thing to me.
Yeah.
So always where I've been is about the passion and the obsession to help create and get better. So, I mean, it was also for cultural, it was important because I spent half of my life in Europe. So for me, it was important to go see different cultures and also just out of curiosity, how is American sport is like? And because I love basketball, that's my second favorite sport. Like the Chicago Bulls. That's me.
The Jordan era.
Yeah, that was me. That's what I grew up. You know, the Magics and the Jordan. So basketball always spoke to me. But the other thing that spoke to me about the U.S. is the mindset of when it comes to sport. Right, U.S. always seemed to be ahead when it always comes to the mindset of sports. And then I refer to basketball. I refer to like the runnings, right?
The track,
right? The athletic sides of it, right? They were always ahead because on the track, U.S. were always back, minus the dopings. But but they always seems to have an edge when it comes to the competition side of what it meant, because maybe people didn't respect them that much when it comes to other sport besides basketball and track and field, right? So being able to come to the U.S., being able to see, and this is 2013, mind your words, this is not when they was running, kicking PKs in 96. No, you remember when they were kicking like this? Because I remember now when I heard about it, I'm like, nah, that's silly. In 96, why would you? The game tied. But again, we talk about cultural stuff. U.S.
Ties are not there.
Ties don't mean nothing.
Yeah.
It's like win or lose.
Yeah.
Right? That's the mindset of either you win or you lose. Tie what is tie, right?
Yeah.
So that kind of spoke to me. And coming back in 2013, seeing the level what MLS was mine, it was still good, was great players still. The Robbie Keynes of the world, the Becksons of the world, the Javi Morales, the... I don't know how many, the David Villas, all of these worlds, right? So you do. So it was an attraction for these European players knowing that they could come to America, they could walk freely without being recognized.
Yeah.
Which was also a huge thing because, the football was not massive. So sometimes people also got to understand that we want to try something because of what we used to in the countries that we were is mm-hmm. more than what it is here.
Yeah.
So it kind of gives you a relief, sense of relief for you, for your family.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because even though there's a lot of talks about US now, it's still a place that me, I'm very happy to see my kids grow because mm-hmm. they can be who they are without sure. the pressure of who your father was or who your mom mm-hmm. is and what is happening around and those constantly talk about what mm-hmm. they do. But the level of the infrastructure has gone up.
Yeah.
Which me, I believe in 2026, Canada or US can be a major surprise
mm.
in the World Cup. Because you see some of the facilities that are now, are not even in Europe.
Mm.
Like MLS is rivaling Europe step by step. And you go 9 years later
mm.
and you see the level of the talent coming up. You see the level of players getting sold.
Yeah, that's big.
Right? Before it was a retirement league, mm-hmm. but it was a league designed for that because they wanted to attract
yeah.
people. They wanted to attract the global icons, but mm-hmm. of the sports. You know, that makes sense, right? For yeah. me, you see it. So that's why there was always a plan. Don Garber or any road. Lamar Hunt, thank mm-hmm. you for saving MLS because yeah. without MLS, none of us will be here. That's yeah. just the reality of it, right? So
absolutely.
Seeing people that saw a vision and still continue the vision is very important with football, mm-hmm. right? And to see where MLS is now and where MLS is growing to be, there will be a lot of surprise for the coming years,
mm-hmm.
not only with the foreign players, influx of them, what they meant to the league, but as well as the homegrown players coming in and seeing, for example, us
yeah.
selling Pepe.
Yeah.
Who would have thought that 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I wouldn't have thought it 3 years ago when I first met him.
Exactly,
that
right?
3 years later, it'd be, you know.
It would be that money, but that's
crazy.
Life. You know, that
yeah.
is the craziness of life, but that's the craziness of the sports because European are buying potential.
Mm, yeah.
They're not buying ready-made players
yeah.
because they know the difference in, when we talk about the culture,
mm.
the cultures of football, what it really means. I call it football, obviously. You know? So, yeah. sorry.
I'm sure they'll understand.
Yes, right? So, okay, I say soccer. So just to see where soccer is
yeah.
and has been
mm-hmm.
in Europe or around the world to where it is in America. Mind you, we all know in America you got the NFL,
mm.
you got the
yeah.
NBA,
yeah.
you got the NHL.
A lot of competition.
MLBs.
Yeah.
Now soccer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But for sports that it's a blueprint of this is how we do it.
Mm-hmm.
And now here comes a global sport that do it a little bit different.
Yeah.
And then people start scratching their heads because, no, that's not what
we do. Yeah.
We do. Right? So then you created a model which will benefit and suit where the American is, which yeah. for me is normal.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Then you fast forward now and you check how many American owners are on football clubs around the world.
Yeah. A whole lot.
A whole lot. Right?
Especially in England.
Especially in England,
yeah.
right? So the global game is changing.
Yeah.
To the greater good of people because it's advancing and it's going around the world.
And for players too.
Oh yeah.
You know, like in terms of the infrastructure and development and coaching.
Man.
All of it.
Everything. And that is when you see growth.
Yeah.
And for me, that's where you see now the US is understanding, the Canadian is understanding that mm-hmm. that they do possess that. But the infrastructure and having a great structure and model of this is who we're going to be mm-hmm. and never wander away from it, going to bring you success in the long term. Because mm-hmm. I always say you have the choice between short-term success or long-term success.
Mm-hmm.
And I will always go for the long term.
Yeah, makes sense. This is a good segue because my next question was, after retiring at Vancouver,
yeah.
you went pretty much straight into coaching.
Yeah.
What, was that always the plan? And you mentioned the coach, but when you were young, said that he wanted to see you as a coach. So had that always been in the back of your mind or did
no.
it just fall into the place?
It fell into place because, like I said, me growing up, you always look for role models in different things that people are different because they look like you.
Hmm.
So me, when people ask me if I had a role model in football, I never had.
Hmm.
My role model was Muhammad Ali.
Okay.
For what he stood for.
Mm, outside of
as
sport.
A man.
Yeah.
Because my grandfather was somebody that taught me a lot in life. So for him, one of the biggest lessons was, if you're going to be a recognizable person,
mm-hmm.
be always a recognizable person for who you are as a man, not for what you're doing.
Mm.
Make sense?
Yeah. How you use your platform.
So, and at that time, it's not a platform as big as what we have now.
Yeah.
But me growing up, seeing what he stood for and what he was preaching spoke to me as a man.
Yeah.
And what I was seeing, right?
Especially growing up in Norway.
Especially growing up in Norway, being, right? Yeah. Being one of, right? So seeing what is, observing things around me, like I say, you understand that you're in a privileged situation, but also you're in a situation, if you mess up, you know, the, you're the scapegoat.
Yeah.
You know?
That makes sense. So you went into coaching first and the assistant roles and whatnot, but your first head coaching experience, Pacific FC in the Canadian Premier League, you know, first full season with them, you win the Premier League, and then coach of the year. What was that season like in, you know, it being your first big job
as a coach? It was, I mean, back to your point, right? You I played for 20 years, so that gives me an insight of... I learned from different coaches. I've learned from some of the best coaches in the world. I learned from Alain Perrin, who won the league in France with Olympique Lyon, having great players in Benzema, great players, all of this. And he was my coach in the Middle East. I had Huub Stevens, who coached Schalke to UEFA Cup. He was my coach at the Roda. And I was fortunate enough to spend time, like I said, with Sir Alex Ferguson. I was fortunate enough to spend time with Louis van Gaal, who opened my eyes in different ways and stuff. So I was been fortunate around to see coaches at the very highest level and exchange ideas or taking ideas from what they're doing, right? So for me, it was the curious side of the game. But did I look at myself as being one of them? I'll be honest, no. Because like I said, I didn't have no role models that I would say, you know, this black coach is doing well. Or, but and for us, it was not a door open for black coaches.
Yeah.
Right? So stubborn as I am, in my mind went to, all right, I'm like, so that played a part. At the end, seeing that I had a great relationship with Alfonso Davies, mentoring him into becoming becoming something that nobody thought he could become, that was for me was the greatest joy, was because I was in the background and I enjoyed it, right? So me and him working together on things that I believe that if he did, it will pave his way to Europe, which was his dream. So I mean, that's why I gotta give thanks to Carl Robinson, who was my coach at Whitecaps, because he saw me as a player coach.
Okay.
So he was the one also telling me, right, you know, you pushing me the direction. So at first I was like, nah, you know, I just want to enjoy, finish my career, enjoy my family, you know. If my wife want to work, she go to work, you know, then I can just sit home, take care of the kids and other things. But then that little spark of, it's not many of us in coaching, right? And for me, if I start something, I got to finish it, right? So starting that, I was like, I thought my wife will divorce me, I'll be honest. I thought she would divorce me because I left home 6:30 in the morning, came back home 7 o'clock in the evening.
Jeez.
Just because I needed to do those steps, right? Because when you're a player, you forget that you're a player. And that's what I always tell these players. When you are a player, enjoy that side. Because once you don't play, you become a regular job.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you cannot live off your fame or needing that fame. Life goes on.
It's a short career.
It's a short career. So you got to make the most of it so that you, first, financially, you set your family is good. But second, you leave a legacy. Because that's what you're going to be judged upon.
Yeah.
Right? So make sure that you're finally stable for your family, the good, everything you said, but leave a legacy. Because when everything is gone, that legacy will live forever. So for me, that was the important part. And also seeing where soccer was going in the US, I was feeling like, you know what, I got to give back to the game what the game gave me for 20 years. So that's why also I went into coaching. But also to break down barriers.
Yeah.
To also make people see that we are more than just being players. You know, because when we talk about the narrative and the perspective, it's like when you look at when how people will portray or put people in certain positions, it's like, oh, he can do it because he maybe spoke to the media this way or he was that, right? I was never that. People will look at me sometimes and say, he was confrontational or he speaks his mind. But I believe in speaking my mind because that's who I am. But one thing I do, I respect everybody, and I respect everybody's opinion. Mm-hmm. But if people try to tell me smoke, I'm going to call you up. Mm-hmm. And not everybody likes that, right? Not everybody likes that.
That's true.
That's just who I am. Mm-hmm. What you're going to get from me is the truth. Mm-hmm. How you handle that truth, that's up to you.
Yeah.
I'm not forcing it up on you. But if you ask me for something mm-hmm. and you truly want to hear my opinion, I'm going to give it to you. Mm-hmm. Then it's not maybe not what you would like to hear, but at least you know that you got it, where you stand.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can be a problem for some people because they may not use it. And I'm black. That's just the reality of it, right? I'm not going
to
hide it.
Different responses to the same thing.
Different responses to the same thing, right?
Yeah.
And then different doors.
That's true, yeah.
It's different doors that won't be open. Mm-hmm. Right? That's just the reality of it. And me knowing that, it didn't faze me. Because I'm like, all right, doesn't matter what doors they opening or they closing. But they're going to open it. Mm-hmm. Either way. So for me, it was staying true to myself and my belief in what I wanted to be as a coach. So going back to the example of those other coaches I have, mm-hmm. right? You look, you open your eyes, you read, right? But for me, the one thing I always believed in is hold the players accountable, mm-hmm. hold myself accountable first. Because mm-hmm. if I want my players to do something, I got to show it. I got to hold the standard. Mm-hmm. And then working with people that share the same passion and obsession of making the place better people first. Mm. Those things are the three things that me, I will not negotiate. It's not negotiable for me. So me going to the person that was it. And then holding different roles as assistant was important because I always tell ex-players, when you stop for me, I even tell my players, when you stop, go start at the youth. Mm-hmm. Go at the youth. Because the first team level everywhere, I've spent it for 20 years, nothing much going to change.
Yeah.
But for me as a coach, that's a new mm-hmm. career. Mm-hmm. So I got to go deep ways down. I got to go back to the roots.
Yeah.
Like me playing.
And that's also in terms of making people better people. If you start younger, you have a bigger effect on who they are.
Oh, yeah.
Than if coaching a 29-year-old guy.
100%. Because that's what I say. And for me, that's where the greatest joy is because somebody at 29, you're not teaching, you're managing.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody at 8, 9, you are teaching. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you're teaching life lessons. Mm-hmm. You're not teaching football, because football is life lesson.
Yeah.
Right? So for me, it's all about teaching lessons that they can later use in their daily life, mm-hmm. which is holding yourself accountable, which is being a good person, mm-hmm. but also doing everything to the best of your ability. Mm-hmm. That's three things that is
you can apply that anywhere.
You can apply it anywhere. Yeah, so for me, it's about the teaching of life because not everybody gonna make it. Mm-hmm. So not everybody gonna make it. What do we have to do as coaches? Now it becomes my job to make sure that he can get success somewhere else. Mm-hmm. If it's not the game, maybe it's being still in the game or going and maybe starting a company or doing something.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, yeah, and certainly not everybody makes it. I mean, it's a small, tiny fraction.
That's the reality.
I didn't make it, but I'm lucky enough to work in sports still. So
and
so
you scored against us. So I still didn't forget the Super Classico. Huh?
It was a lucky one. You know, kind of off that conversation, is that what motivated you to come to North Texas, where it is a second team and the, kind of the bridge between youth soccer and professional? So it's kind of like that happy medium.
I mean, after being the full head coach at Pacific, you know, you go on and you win the league, right? Mm-hmm. And then obviously you beat Vancouver Whitecaps, where now you caught the attention mm-hmm. and the eyes of people because obviously people's like, that's an MLS club. Losing to a Canadian team, different budgets.
Yeah.
Right? Whew. They have a budget of 30 million. They have a budget of 2 million. How can they lose?
Yeah.
But it's football.
Yeah.
That's what I was keep telling people. The game is played inside the white mm-hmm. lines, mm-hmm. but it's played inside the white lines because of what you've installed into people. Mm-hmm. And people forget, half of those kids are from the Whitecaps. So the day that we played the Whitecaps, half of those kids are from the Whitecaps. They went through the Academy of Whitecaps. Mm. They were never given a chance.
They weren't, yeah. So they had a chip on their shoulder.
So they have a chip on your shoulder. And me being an ex-Vancouver Whitecaps, knowing them, but also we were fortunate enough to play them in preseason, where they needed a game because they didn't have no opposition. Mm-hmm. So we played them in February in the preseason. And we lost 2-0. We were just a week into preseason. So going back on the ferry, I tell the boys, I'm like, guys, this opens your eyes of what is it to be a professional club and learning to becoming a professional, which we were, because we were a very young club. That was the third year.
Yeah.
Now you've been a professional club, so we're not an established club. So we're trying to be established. So I tell them in the ferry, I'm like, remember this day. Because if we get chance to play them in the Canadian Cup, you're not losing. Mm-hmm. You won't win. Because that was for me to see how they're playing, observe how they are, what they're doing. And obviously, they didn't have a good run stretch out there. People can say this. But for me, my belief in what we can achieve and the chip that they had on their shoulder, that helped us win the game. And that brought attention to Pacific, to who we were at Pacific and the things we were doing. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and after, like I said, you win a championship, being the first black man. I don't know in North America, but I think in North America, being the first black man to win a championship in soccer, I'm the first.
Special.
That was for me special. My captain being black, that's special. That doesn't happen often. So being able to showcase that was another milestone for me to showcase that, hey, we are capable of doing that if we are giving up the same equal opportunities. Mm-hmm. Right? But even though I know those same equal opportunities not gonna happen, but I gotta do it on my own beat. I'm not looking for people to hand it to me either. That's not what I'm saying. I don't want people to hand me things because I don't respect when people just hand you things. So having a great session, winning it, and then getting calls. Obviously, people want to do interview with you. People want to know who you are, you know, just to see who you are as coach, who you are as a person. But for me, what spoke to me about this job was funny story. When I first came in 2013, the first time we came to Dallas, I called my wife. I'm like, I found our retirement place. I'm like, hot, nice, weather's always good. It reminds me of Middle East. I'm like, when we're done, we just come here, you know? So I've been preaching about Dallas, and people always like look at me, but also the way that the club was in terms of homegrowns under Oscar Pareja, how to develop the homegrowns, how to give them opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I was like, right? On the Marco, the same, right? So you, and then at that time, there was a nice rivalry between Portland and Dallas. So it was always great matches, you know? And then you just see it, and you see it on the pitch. So for me, seeing that and seeing the amount of talents that this club have, and I was also fortunate enough to speak and get interviewed by Dan Hunt, who saw me, who knew me as a player, but didn't know me as a coach. Yeah. And also talking to Andre Zanotta, who is an exceptional man with a great resume of being a GM and a sporting director on the Santos, the time of Neymar, you know, stuff like this. So for me, these are other things for me to learn from people that are in positions where they can teach me and I can learn more and get better. So for me, my choices are always based upon challenges, right? Where can I continue to challenge myself? Who can I continue to challenge? Can I still continue to challenge the status quo of the thought process of what is it to be a soccer coach, and as well as the learning. So for me, it made sense for my own development to come here, because like I say, this is one of the founding fathers of MLS.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody knows sooner or later, I want to go MLS, but that's not my thought. My thought is, can I take my steps, steps that I need to make sure that when the calling comes, I'm ready. Because people like me, you get half a chance and you got to make it work. You got to take it.
Yeah.
Right? I'm no doors going to be just be fully open for me. So that's why, rather than just always want to jump into something, no, I always take the steps I need because it's my own beat.
I like that.
I'm doing it on my own beat.
I like that. Thank you so much for your time, Paul. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Anytime, my guy.